Hello, this is Sophie, and you're listening to the Jew and the Gentile podcast.
I'm Charles Breton.
I'm Helena Epstein.
And I'm Chris Henson. Together we are
a Jew
and
a Gentile walking to
a bar
mitzvah.
Well, it's taken us a while, but we've hit episode 111. We're all ones. We're the number one. We have a one for the Jew, a one for the Gentile, and a one for the ampersand of reason. Isn't that just fabulous? So welcome to this podcast where you'll find theology, cigars, whiskey, and F-bombs. And as always, like to mention that if you found us any other way other than on our website or through Twitter or our Facebook, you could also find us on Stitcher and iTunes.
Working on Spotify now that I'm
on Spotify.
They're very technical, those people.
And also Theology Corner at theologycorner.net. And we're always proud to say that we are part of the Wild Goose Goosecast Network. This is a network of faith-based podcasts discussing issues of inclusion and social justice. To learn more about the Wild Goose Festival, go to wildgoosefestival.org. And this is the point in our podcast where we like to acknowledge our sponsors.
So we said Shamelessly plug them.
Because a lot of them literally fuel our podcasts. Men of the Beard. They
certainly make them more tolerable to listen to.
That's true. Men of the Beard oil, and especially in this time of...
Wait, how does beard oil make it easier
to make the liquor comment. Sponsors.
No, I'm trying to explain this. One of the ways it makes it tolerable is especially now that everybody's sheltering in space.
Sheltering in space!
In place.
Love that on the Muppets.
Yeah. For
hashtag,
some of us that
#shelter in space.
Sheltering in place. Some of us have partners that we're doing that with, and having a nice soft beard.
Oh, I thought we were going back to like, can it be used as a personal lubricant conversation?
No.
Okay.
We've had that conversation so many times.
Yeah, that's worn out already. I was going for the whole nice soft beard. Keeps the wife happy, and then I'm
so cranky. You know, a different kind of lubricant.
Yeah, exactly. But if you want to listen, Shabbos. If you want to have it a better Shabbos. Time listening to us, then two of our sponsors are right up your alley: Virgil Cane Whiskey, their Robber Baron Rye. It's the official rye whiskey of our podcast.
Are those the dogs of the apocalypse?
Hush your mouth. Yes.
I can't do anything about them, man.
Wreak Havoc. Four Saints Brewing Company in Ashboro. Four Saints is still operating. The tap room is closed, but you can order and have curbside pickup available. Top Leaf Lounge, Scar Lounge, the premium lounge in Winston-Salem. Winston-Salem is also in a shelter-in-place order, and so Top Leaf will not be open for a while, but you can still follow them. Bethany is still texting and Facebooking.
I can't believe tobacco is not essential in Winston-Salem.
We're named after two cigarettes, you would think.
I know.
Right. Just North Carolina in general, but specifically Winston-Salem.
Right, the home of Camel.
Imagine that.
Hey, we saw her today.
We did. I went social distancing grocery shopping with Nat today. It was awesome.
Cool.
Yeah.
And I sacrificed one of either my daughter or my wife's face mask for Helena to have one. So we're going to wait and see who gets sick. So Helena,
oh my
you
God,
have,
you can't put that pressure on me.
So now, yeah, really guilt her. That's
yeah,
really.
You can't.
I'm attached to both of them.
Why do you think she converted? Was to get away from the guilt.
Well,
I found a whole new pile of it, Chris.
You're killing your mother. No, but she is. I've been trying to get her up on our social media feeds, and we'll get it on the website. She is crafting masks. I mean, they're not going to be obviously your PPE that you would need for like medical situations, but can definitely just be a way to prevent spreading, if nothing else, seasonal allergies and all the other good things that come with that. And it's a great way to support a local crafter that's part of her income, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
which Helena bartered for with a roll of toilet paper. Today.
I did. I bought my mask with a roll of toilet paper, y'all. Like, that was serious.
That's pretty cheap. Only over one roll.
Yeah. Have you looked at the prices on Amazon, man?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's pretty cheap. It was that. No, I'm not saying that the toilet paper was cheap. I'm saying
the mask was cheap.
That she was willing to take just one roll. Because I've seen the quality of her work.
I paid in cash, so
I think I got the friend's discount a little bit.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. She knocked off a roll and a half.
Yeah, I got a mustache one, and she's got the Dia de Muertes. She has Stacy's mask, is what it amounts to.
Basically, yeah. So it sounds,
you know what? We need to give a hoorah and a cheer for Trucker Jeff, because he's doing a very, very, important job these days in this country.
Yep.
Yes, he is.
Yep.
Which, because he now has taste, he'll never hear this comment, but here we go. Maybe his ears will burn and he'll wonder why.
Probably. So, speaking of cigar lounges being closed, what are you smoking? We know Helena's still on her camels.
Yep.
So, yep. Chris, it's up to you and me.
So, I went to Pipe and Pint in Winston. I forget the guy that the owner operator, Jason. But he saw me and he's like, "How's Charles?" I'm like, "Oh shit, what am I?
How the hell do I know?"
I told him you're on cigar lockdown.
Yeah,
which sounds a lot more horrible to like explain to him that you have to smoke outside, but you can smoke your pipe still inside in your lounge. But
correct.
So several.
We're all making sacrifices right now.
Several ounces of different tobaccos there today for my pipe. The one I smoked today was actually their Virginian, not the six Virginians, but just one.
Just one.
And I finally think I won't say mastering, but I smoked that down to the nub, if you can, I can use that analogy, in a clay pipe that I really had not used in years. No. It burned well. It had a lot of sweet flavors to it. Mm-hmm. Some floral notes, oddly. I wasn't expecting that.
You can get that with some Virginians. Because
at first I was like, did somebody clean this with like dish detergent? Because I was not expecting it. And they had a lot of nuttiness to it. It was the kind of that flue cured barley that's been mixed with flake and something else. Mm-hmm. I forget, but it was really good. I also picked up their a few other more aromatic blends. And I still already had the good Cavendish blend last time I smoked, but. Right.
That dish soap thing didn't make that sound particularly appealing, Chris.
Well, because I didn't know what else to. Right. I was like, God, what am I tasting? And of course, I'm being the panic and negative person that I can be sometimes. I thought, well, good grief, some idiot cleaned this with something they weren't supposed to. But it's my pipe.
It would
never do that to
induced cleaning or something.
Yeah, someone ran it through the dishwasher or something.
Well, it would not surprise me, but it's a clay pipe, so it's survived. So I'm thinking not, but it doesn't have any cake in it yet still, so I'm still working.
So we have a special guest with us, and he wants to chime in. James Prescott, all the way from London.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
Good to be here. Hi. It's a real privilege to be here. I love it. It's so great.
Bit wild sometimes.
Yeah. No, the reason I brought James is because the last thing that I picked up at Pipe and Pipe before pandemic stuff happens to be a pipe tobacco by Esterica Tablicana, and it's called their Margate, which is an English blend, which is one of my favorites. So it's not a heavy on the Latakia, which I absolutely enjoy the ones that are heavy on the Latakia. Virginia's as the base, obviously, and then has the Oriental and Turkish tobaccos and Latakia. So you have those woody, earthy, grassy, floral, almost spicy from the Virginians, the Orientals giving some sweet, woodsy, and smokiness to them, a little dry and sourness from the Oriental as well, and the Latakia just giving that nice, deep, musty, smoky lovely flavor that I've been enjoying very much.
You're creating your own miasma so that you can avoid this plague is what I'm hearing.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But love a good English blend. And this is definitely a lovely English blend.
Which is how we invited James on the show, is because he's a lovely English blend.
Exactly.
What happened?
Well, I just met the guy.
Well, so. Yeah. We're not digging that far into his background, Helena.
I was like, okay, so how are we connecting this?
You haven't been outside but once this week, have
you? Yeah, no, I haven't. I haven't.
That's the first time that's ever been said to me, I think.
You're welcome.
You know, a lot of our guests say that something we say is the first time someone has said that to them.
Really?
We're pretty wide open. Yeah.
So we're definitely keeping the trend going, that's for sure. before we continue to say things to James has never been said to him before, Chris, you want to edit in a nice commercial for us, and then we'll come back and we'll have a serious conversation.
Only if you ask nicely.
Chris, would you please plug a sponsor?
Please plug a sponsor, Chris.
Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey started with one goal: to create the best damn whiskey around. Drawing on their culinary know-how and driven by flavor, founders David and Ryan, both accomplished chefs, were inspired to boldly blend, infuse, and tinker with choice ingredients to craft category-shattering whiskeys, proving that it's not about stuffy tradition, but about taking what you know and taking chances. Each of their spirits is a tribute to their dedication to making whiskey their way, a whiskey they'd want to drink. Again, Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey. A damn fine whiskey.
And now for something completely different.
And we're back. And we have a special guest with us all the way from across the pond. This episode, we are joined by James Prescott, writer, author, podcaster, exploring our spiritual and creative journey and the intersections between faith, creativity, and identity. He is the host of the Poema Podcast, a podcast on spirituality, creativity, and reclaiming the art of conversation.
It's on iTunes and I believe Podbean, I think.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pretty much anywhere you get podcasts. So that's what I tell people now, because there's so many podcast platforms now. There's, you know, iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and loads of other ones that I don't even know. So anyway, you get your podcast, you can find it. So
we're ignored on all those things you mentioned,
by the way, everyone. Home and on the end, that's it. It's got a photo of me on it, so you'll know it's me.
Okay, well, one of the reasons we've invited James, not just to talk about creativity and faith, James has also been doing a lot with the idea of grief and grieving recently, and that's something that a lot of us are going through, but also because James is going to be speaking at Wild Goose for the first time.
Everybody's favorite summer pastime.
Yeah, so we'd break him in. So Jay, is this it's your first time speaking, but will this be your first time attending Wild Goose?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, obviously this is if it goes ahead, because it doesn't look like it will at the moment, but if it goes ahead, that'd be really great to be there. And my first time, I'm excited to go. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I don't get to go this year, I will go next year, and because it's something I've always wanted to go to anyway, and I know a lot of friends that go there and friends that speak there, and mm-hmm. And the area is such a beautiful area, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. One of the things you definitely have to do is, well, two things. First is
two things.
The first is you have to go to the Sugar Shack, which is one of the food vendors.
Oh, okay.
And what is Dylan, that the thing?
Dylan's not going to be there this year. I don't know if the Sugar Shack won't be there, but Dylan will not be.
Oh, because they have is one of the veggie greatest thing? Meals. Yeah, the veggie thing.
I'm hoping he sends the truck, but, you know, I'm on the I'm on a few specialized lists, I guess I'll put it that way.
Because you're special.
Because I'm special. And they sent out a thing the other day that Dylan's not going to be able to make it this year.
Oh, well, okay. Well, then the other thing is Mojo Kitchen, which is a Caribbean Latin food truck. And they do a great take on fish and chips. It's blackened tilapia. And instead of chips, they're fried plantains called tostones. And it is wonderful. So you have to do those two things.
I haven't gone to that one, Charles. I'll have to go this year.
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, I because I'm international, I'm in London. So it depends if they're allowing travel by then, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I it's going to be difficult for me to book in advance. I've kept the time booked off just in case, you know, but it'll be a last minute flight thing if it happens. But I've got to be sensitive to, you know, the situation with everything. So
absolutely.
If I lived in America, I wouldn't have so much of a problem. Like, I'd probably be there, but it just depends. We don't know, so much is up in the air right now. So much is uncertain.
Right.
Yeah. And so, speaking of which, things being uncertain, that is for a lot of us at this time. What were the ideas? I know you had mentioned that grief and grieving was part of what you may be talking about, the goose. So how are you looking at that? Because I know for a lot of people, and we've had J. Dana Trent on, did a wonderful book on grieving in terms of mourning. And we tended to think of this a lot in just in terms of the loss of a family member or friend. But we're losing a lot of things. So where are you seeing that interconnection?
Well, even before this happened, I was thinking a lot about grief and how grief is something that all of us are carrying around all the time. When you move house, when you lose your job, when the relationship ends, when your child goes to school for the first time, when your child goes to college, you know, it's when a season of your life ends, something that was important to you or that was part of your everyday life in a way, and then it's kind of just taken away from you, whether that's suddenly and unexpectedly or whether that's like, you know, kind of a rite of passage, like going to school or going to college. Even when you get married, there's a kind of grieving for that life that you had before. Because when I'm not married, but it's a change of moving from living by yourself to living with somebody else. There's a grieving of what you've lost. Even if the thing that you've now got is better. We carry around grief all the time. And sometimes it's grief for a life that could have been. Part of my grieving was not just that I lost a parent 20 years ago, but about 15 years before that, that same parent suffered brain damage when they had an asthma attack. And so the person that they were not the same person in some ways. They still were in many ways, but the possibility of the life that they could have had kind of died. And of course, the life that me and myself and my sister would have had, that life changed as well. So there was a grieving there as well of a life that could have been that wasn't. So we're carrying around grief all the time, and this has just heightened it, what's happened with the pandemic, because we're all losing a lot of things. We're losing basically our way of life that we've had, like, you know, for our whole lives. Our whole routines have been thrown out. Some people are losing jobs. Some people are unable to see loved ones. Some people are losing loved ones. Some people are... Yeah, I mean, there's just so many different forms of grief that people are experiencing right now. What we're experiencing is a collective grief, and it's really important to process that grief in a healthy way, because if we process grief in an unhealthy way, that actually ends up grief can come out in really unhealthy and toxic ways. So, yeah, and like, I mean. Like, you know, there's so many ways that we process grief in an unhealthy way. Like for me, what I did is I kind of got into religious certainty. I got into kind of progressive fundamentalism and conservative fundamentalism as well, like at different stages in my life. Overeating, you know, and just building, I built a structure around my pain. I had a steady job. I had a steady church. I had a steady home group. I had a mortgage. I had like all of that kind of certainty and structure and everything. But I was still carrying around this pain, and I knew that it was in there. I just wasn't dealing with it. And what I'd done is build a structure around my pain instead of building a structure into my pain. And what I ended up doing with the help of like a life coach and a spiritual director and counselor, therapist, and mindset coach was learning to build a structure that allowed me to go in and out of my pain, my grief, and feel that without it having the power to control me. Because that's the key. Because we'll always have grief that we're carrying around with us. We'll always have wounds that we're carrying around with us. But it's just how we respond to that that we need to change. Like, so I still experience grief. My whole life has changed. Like the way I'm not able to go to work. I have to work from home. So even now, like, things have changed, but I've now learned how to navigate that without it controlling me. And that's the key. We need to create routines and healthy structures, which allow us to lean into our pain and be free of its power. And that's a healthy way to process grief. And the first step to doing that is to acknowledge that you have grief that you're carrying around with you.
Yes.
Yeah.
12-step process, you know, the 12-step program, the first step is actually telling the truth, like saying, yeah, I'm messed up right now. I'm carrying a lot of stuff right now. I've got a lot of stuff that I'm processing that I need to deal with. Well,
and you know that, so I'm a member of the 12-step community personally, and that is like you said, it's the key. Also the hardest part, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. Especially in, I don't know, you know, I've never lived in Britain. I don't know kind of the cultural ethos as well as I do American ethos, but here we're so individualistic and so have this like self-determining, like will thing that to say, I don't have control. I'm having this pain. I'm having this problem and I need to acknowledge it is like pulling teeth. It's painful to have to do that, and I think that's part of like starting the grieving process, right, is acknowledging that it's painful already and it's going to be painful to move through, right? But you can't go around it, you have to go through it. Yeah. And people don't want to do that. The other thing I was thinking, you know, you're talking about, you know, building structures, right? And I know from a pastoral perspective, a lot of the structures that we encourage people to develop are communal structures, community and networking, right? Mm-hmm. So that you're not alone. And I was thinking about that in regards to this particular point in our history and as our collective experience is that we're isolated in a new way now, right? That makes that structuring really and that's part of what we're grieving, right? Is our loss of structure.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really interesting having done all this work on myself where I began to get comfortable with uncertainty and mystery and risk in my life and in my emotional life and in my spiritual life. And now I'm observing this happening to other people. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. It feels like this is going to be a big moment because I think after this is over, people are going to have to deal with their grief, and how they deal with their grief will define how we move forward as a culture, I think, and also that how the church moves forward, because I think people, but I just have this sense that when people come, people, some people will try and go back to their normal lives and try and just go back to the way things were, and they will have this sense in their inner being that they can't do that they will go and try it, and then it will realize that no, I can't go back to how things were. Things have changed.
I don't know that we'll have the luxury to do that, frankly, even if we wanted to.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we don't know, do we? I say, I mean, that's the thing. Everything is uncertain right now. We don't know how it's going to fall out. You know, we don't know how what we're going to be. And so we need to, I mean, we're going to need to start doing some of this work now. The thing we can do now is acknowledge that it's there, and we can journal. Like, journaling is one of the best things you can do for your, not just your mental health, but your emotional health and your physical health. There's evidence that it improves your physical health to journal your emotions on a daily basis, on a regular basis.
And it's interesting you say that, because I'm not typically a journaler. Really, I'm not. I keep a daily, like, log of what I'm doing and what's happening, but not necessarily, you know, there's a little bit of self-consciousness about putting your thoughts and feelings on a page, right? Where someday someone might be able to see what your feelings were at any given time, right? It's vulnerable.
Yeah.
But I mean, for the last 2 weeks, I have been every day just putting it down, because I need to get it outside of myself. Mm. It needs to be outside of me.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that's good. I mean, there are ways you can keep a journal private. I mean, I have a journal which nobody ever sees, and I don't publish it. You know, I mean, that's not, the idea is that you don't publish it. The idea is that nobody ever sees it. And it's always interesting to look back, actually. Like, I did a lot of journaling during the last few years, and then I looked back a couple of years later at what I've written, and it was really just like, wow, gosh, you know, how much have I grown, you know? So and I mean, that's the thing, we're going to have to become more comfortable with uncertainty. And I mean, I just think people need to learn how to grieve well anyway, whether this has happened or not. I think one of the reasons we've had so many problems in the last few years, both in America and the UK, is that people have just not been able to grieve well. And all this has kind of bottled up. And the response has been, we've seen it in nostalgia for the past, you know, like, take back control, you know, let's go back to the British Empire, you know, kind of thing in England. And then in America, it's like, make America great again, you know, like, as in, like harking back to some time when things are all perfect and great, when they were never like that. And people just haven't grieved the fact that the world has changed. You know, it is so many of the problems in the world are down to unresolved grief and inability to process our emotions and our pain.
You were saying the not being able to go back. I, that was one of the hardest lessons for me to learn, dealing with my own experiences of just crippling depression, is it wasn't until really I gave myself sort of a funeral in my head and said, like, we've got to move on. There's that part of me is dead. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is such a tough, oh my gosh, I spent years to come to that conclusion. And to give myself permission for that. What facilitates grief in your feelings or thoughts, rather, or gets us to that point, or helps us get to that point?
Wait, do you mean like what facilitates us processing grief, or is that what you're asking?
Yes. Or it broad question meant to allow people to kind of interpret that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what James said earlier to me is the key is acknowledging it. Right? You can't process what you don't acknowledge. And I think people have such a fear of vulnerability that they don't even want to begin to acknowledge that they're grieving. You know, they're your major losses, right? Like deaths and divorces and things that people are kind of forced into acknowledging. But the day-to-day griefs, the small losses, the kind of compiling of acknowledging that you don't have control, I think people really struggle with. I know I struggle with that.
Well, I mean, my work with hospice as a chaplain is very common experience is we offer grief care services, and people are like, oh, well, that'll be good after they're dead, after, you know, the family member or loved one's passed. Mm. And trying to help them learn, like, no, you're already grieving. You just may not be aware of it. That in the lost dreams.
The grief before the grief. There is a grieving that happens before somebody passes away. Yeah, because, yeah, grief is, yeah, way, it doesn't just happen when people die. When a loved one gets sick and you know they're going to die, say they're given 4 months to live or something like that, you know, and then you're already grieving before they've gone. You're already in that process of grief. You need to start dealing with that as soon as that happens, because because it's there already. Like it's you know, and it, of course it really, really hits when they do pass away. The, you know, there's a huge difference, but that process begins as soon as you're about to lose something. As soon as you know you're going to lose something that is dear to you, like if you know you're going to, if you know that you're leaving your job, even if you're going to a better job, there's still a grieving that happens before you, that starts before you leave. Well, those last few weeks in your job, you know, you're that's part of grieving what you're leaving behind, even if you're going to something better, because it's been part of your life for so long. And again, it's just about acknowledging that and just sitting with that and allowing and finding ways where you can just do that and then be free of it, and move into whatever's next, you know. And obviously if it's a difficult thing, if it's something like losing somebody, I mean, you definitely need to get support. Like I would always, you need professional support.
It's an education process. I almost wonder if the word grief can be used interchangeably with the word change. Is any experience of change?
There is an element of that. I mean, yeah, any significant change in your life, there's going to be grief involved. Yeah. I mean, it's just a part of, yeah. Grief is not like something that just happens to people who've lost somebody. Grief is something that happens to all of us on a regular basis. We need to, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we shouldn't be ashamed of that. That's part of being human. Yeah. You know, and it's okay. I've said this so many times. It's okay to be human. It's okay to not be perfect. It's okay to acknowledge that you've got stuff you're carrying around with you. It's okay to acknowledge that you're struggling with your emotions and that you're afraid. You know, especially right now, it's really important that people just are able to acknowledge that and able to cry if you need to cry and able to just express that, acknowledge it, because that's the first step to not controlling you, and you can start noticing your emotions. Like now, I notice when I'm feeling angry just in my body. Like the other day, I noticed, because we're all a bit tense right now. We're all a bit on edge. Even the healthiest people emotionally are feeling it. So, you know, I noticed that the other day that I had a bit of anger in my body. You know that, and actually, I realised it was Mother's Day. And it was like, oh, my body knows that there's a problem here. Like, even though I wasn't even thinking about it being Mother's Day, my body kind of knew it was. So there was a kind of all that, there was a little bit of grief there. Like, so I was able to just acknowledge it and let it go. And then when I was feeling a bit of anger around what's happening and all the frustration of people not taking enough responsibility and not, you know, not doing the right thing, and government's not doing the right thing, when I started noticing that, I just stepped away from social media because I knew I needed to just take care of myself. You can learn to notice this stuff. One of the things, I've got a friend who's a therapist, and one of the things they said to me is that, like, breathing, like, just stop and breathe, you know, and just watch your breath, notice your breath, and slow your breath down, and it changes everything, because you start to notice what's going on in your body, you start to feel more relaxed, you start to let go of a lot of that tension, and that's a good practice to have, to come back to yourself. By journaling, and also getting, you see, the outside support and the acknowledgement of what's happening, that's something that you can do.
I want to sort of shift the conversation a little bit, because that's my job. So, you know, obviously there's a lot that we need to be dealing with as individuals, but some things that you'd mentioned, and perhaps something that I think might be important in the wild goose setting, is wanting to get back to normal, but particularly institutions wanting to get back to normal. And this idea that churches, is there things that church leaders should be thinking about doing, about thinking about how do they not say, all right, it's over, everybody come for service and we're back to normal. What kinds of things should they and just people going to church be aware of to institutionally in an institution that doesn't like to be not in control, that doesn't like to change, admit that it has to?
I think that's it. That has to be acknowledged institutionally. Like, you need pastors to come up front and say, look, everything's changed, hasn't it? Like, we've all been through this together. We've all had different experiences of it. They're all valid. How can we serve you in this moment? How can we provide, like, a community which will support you, like, in whatever you're processing? Because, like, and as churches, I guess you can find, I mean, like, Jesus went through all of these things. Jesus went through being a social outcast, even as a child. Mm-hmm. He lost a parent. He was betrayed and abandoned by the people that he trusted the most. He went through severe emotional and physical trauma, pretty much on his own. So I always find solidarity with Jesus. Like, we're talking about our emotional health from a Jesus perspective. I always come back to his story. And I've got a friend who is doing a lot of work on Jesus and emotional health, and we're going to need churches that are able to deal with people's emotional health and to serve that and to hold space for that and talk about it. I think we need churches, pastors, to work with therapists. Like, there's this great organization called Church Therapy who are trying to create a network of therapists who can support churches and support pastors.
Very needed.
Mm-hmm.
Support to people in the congregation. So that, because the pastors are not therapists, and they shouldn't have to carry all of that. I mean, because they're not qualified even to do that. So it's really important that you have professionals, and that pastors can somehow find a way to work with professionals to get support to their congregations that they need, and also to listen to them, to like say, what are you processing? How can we help that? And where can we somehow find Jesus in that? Because Jesus has got a lot to say about emotional health and emotional well-being. And like I said, he's been through all of this. We can connect with that.
The whole incarnate Christ, the notion, God, Charles is probably going to pants me for this, making an Easter reference, since all this will be over by Easter, at least according to our leerless feeder. but no, I mean, Easter Sunday is not a negation of Good Friday.
Right.
Jesus doesn't resurrect. I mean, when he confronts Thomas, he's wounded still. I mean, he's still got scars. I mean, mm-hmm. they didn't just magically go away. And so I think there's something in that, which is very essential to Christian theology and belief. But what do churches do? They show up on Easter Sunday. You can't find a damn one of them Monday, Thursday, Easter Friday, or Good Friday.
Yeah, so. And I agree. I absolutely agree. There's one thing about Jesus as well, which I don't think gets talked about enough. Jesus gets offered vinegar to numb the pain, right, when he's on the cross, right?
And he declines it
because he wants to feel, he knows the only way to be free is to be present in that pain and to feel it and experience it. After that, he's still carrying the wounds of that, but he's free from it. Like, so when he rises again, he's still got all the scars of his trauma. You know, it's just such a good example of how we need to process our emotions and process our grief, in that we need to feel it and acknowledge it. And we'll always be carrying it around with us, but it doesn't have to control us.
I got I did look over at my bookshelf. Nicholas Wolterstorff, they don't have it in print anymore, unfortunately, wrote a book called A Lament for a Son. He wrote it after his son had died in a rock climbing accident. And it's written as a more traditional, like, I guess, First Testament lament. But he makes an argument in his book that maybe one of the reasons we can't see the face of God and survive and live through it is because God's face is also etched with grief. And that can be very painful to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Let me redirect here. We're talking about how pastors can and churches can help the people who are grieving and want to move on. Well, let's flip that. What do you do as a church leader when everyone comes back and says, no, we want everything to be normal, we want it to go back the way it was, we don't want to acknowledge any of this? where's the role there in the church for setting up the, those,
well,
as you said, those, you know, constructions and
nice, easy question.
Nice. Of course, that's what I do. Well, I ask the easy questions.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is the trouble with church, right? Is that people, pastors are people, and they struggle with this too, right? they also struggle with this. But I think speaking truth is really our responsibility and our mandate, right? So saying, I would like this to go back to normal too, however it can't, right? Like just speaking the truth and then helping people navigate that. And I hope that we see that. I don't know that we will, but I hope that we do.
Yeah, that's what we should see. That's what pastors should be doing. We need to be prophetic about it and to say, you know what? Things have changed whether we like it or not. And we need to face that. Yeah, and like you say, I'm afraid I have this fear too that there will be whole communities and leaders who will just retreat into certainty because that's the unhealthy response to grief. I actually saw this happen with a pastor that I knew who was all about mystery and uncertainty and doubt and faith and questioning and everything, and then went through a major, major experience of grief and retreated into certainty. And that is a danger that people can do that because certainty is almost easy. You can, it's a good way to hide from the pain. It's a good way to.
I was going to say, I don't know if easy is the right word. Comfortable, maybe.
Yeah, that's
but in the long run, it exaggerates the pain because you know unaddressed pain just builds until it screams until you have to address it.
That's right.
The form of addiction.
What do you say to the congregation who says no? But that's what we want church to be. We want it to be that comfort and certainty.
All right.
We want
first
it that
all,
one place where I can be certain and safe. So what do you? That's what.
So saying. As the
what
pastor,
do we do with that congregant besides kick them out of your office, Chris?
Well, that's this is not a new thing for churches. It's just a new reason. I mean,
most
churches
that's what I'm
in the U.S. are still harking back to the 40s and 50s with this sort of naive, oh, everything was great back then, till you bring up the rights of women, persons of color, persons with different gender orientation, sexual orientations, et cetera, et cetera. It's good for a few. It is, you know. But this is going to be different. But I also think that God, I can't believe I'm going to be positive. Jeez, I must be.
the world is
it's only taken 111 episodes, folks.
This is my thought is, what if it also our experience of teaming together, even if it's virtually, even if it's in new ways and finding ways to be community. I mean, it doesn't have to be a sum total loss.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, I actually said that I was in a meeting on Saturday with I'm on the COVID response team for my church as well as my region. And you know, we were talking about closing the church, right? Not just letting some people in and out, just saying no. You know, and I said, well, you know, you can put a sign on the door that says we're really sorry, you can't come back in until June 1st and this really sucks. They were like, I don't think we should say that. And I said, why not? Like, why? I mean, if you don't want to use that specific verbiage, don't. But I think acknowledging that this is really sad and really disruptive is healthy right now. Like trying to sugarcoat that is really not helpful for people. So in some ways, Charles, you're asking about what to do when we get back. We need to be addressing what we're doing now and how we're allowing people to process this now instead of waiting.
Yeah, and a lot of it has to work, and that's what I'm talking about. But how do you respond when you're doing this, like putting that sign up and people saying, no, but church is where I want to come and be protected from all this bad stuff outside. I don't want to deal with it in here.
Well, that's a key theological issue that needs to be addressed, right? Church isn't supposed to be comfortable. It never was.
But yeah, most people don't think that.
Right. But there is comfort, right? It's not that it's comfortless and it won't there, you know, but I think talking about the things that Chris and James were referring to, right? The acknowledging the aspects of our narrative that talk about discomfort, talk about pain, talk about loss, talk about grief, connect people to those pieces of the narrative and say, you're not alone.
So right? What about we throw the word out there? But no, the word resilience, what I was beating around the bush for. And how do we practice and teach resilience in the face of change?
Resilience is only learned through practice. You have to build up resilience. You know, working this stuff through. Like I've become more resilient by actually working this stuff through, like working through my grief and my trauma and actually confronting it head on and learning from people like mindset coaches and therapists and life coaches and things like practices which can help me to navigate them, then you start to build up resilience.
What are some of your epiphanies or discoveries along that? There are things like these were helpful practices for me. We always try to, when we have subjects like this, just to see what are some takeaways. And I'll stop talking so you can talk. But
what are some takeaways?
Yeah, or just that you've learned through your journeys with grief. This worked. This didn't work. This was helpful. This
was right. Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense. What didn't work was trying to hide from my grief and my pain and trying to pretend like it wasn't happening and trying to just think that going to church and having a stable structure in church was gonna solve the problem and just my life would be okay and I just have to carry this stuff around. That was counterproductive. That was negative. That made it worse. I mean, it looked like my life was okay on the surface. It looked like I had it all together. It looked like I was healthy. It looked like I was doing well. And I probably could have kept going like that, but I would have been carrying this stuff around. And what really worked well was acknowledging it and talking to experts about it and finding a safe community where I could talk about it.
Yeah.
Practices that worked for me were journaling and meditation and silent prayer. And I did yoga as well, which really helps. It'll be different for different people. Different people will have their own practices which work for them,
right?
Which you can experiment with. And so finding some new routines and practices, finding healthy community where I could just talk about this stuff, finding expert help, and being willing to actually feel the pain, like to acknowledge that it would get worse before it gets better, because that's actually part of the process. Like, and that was part of the process for me. It got worse before it got better. You know, I went to a lower, darker place before I started getting really healthy again. But the payoff was that after that, I was really free and I was healthy and the pain did not have any power over me anymore. It was not, I was free of its power, you know, and that when you really feel that, it's an amazing thing, because that's when you start to build that resilience, because you know that even if you go through difficult stuff and you might have a lot of grief and a lot of wounds and a lot of trauma that you carry around, you will be able to navigate your way out of it because you have those things in your life that can bring you out of it.
I had to do a real identity check. I mean, my biggest experience thus far with grief, knock on wood, has been just overcoming depression, struggling for years with that, and then finally having some epiphanies. Was one of them was people that like, oh, you're going to be like your old self again. I was like, fuck, I hope not. That son of a bitch was sick. He damn near killed me. But having to actually tell loved ones and friends like, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. I can't be a part of that identity. You know, I had to own the fact that I've never been an extrovert. I am an introvert. I can fake it real good. And just having to tell people these are my boundaries. Like I cannot live in that husk that you all remember fondly that I just felt trapped in. But I have some very real hard conversations of just, sorry, he's dead. And I mean, that's the exact words I used, but also said that that's okay. You know, his time had come to an end, you know, and would have been healthier if he'd have died younger, in a manner of speak, metaphorically speaking. It's tough.
That's been one of the biggest challenges for me, is actually connecting with my best self, my truest self, the person I've become, or the person I've started to to see. I've always been, but being that person around people that I've known my whole life, not because they would judge me for it,
right?
Because I know they wouldn't. It's just that there's something about it that you feel a bit like unsafe being that person around them, and because you have habits formed around being around them, like mannerisms and behaviors that you just automatically turn on when you're around them. So, like when I went to San Diego last year, I was able to be completely myself, the person I'd become, without any fear, because there was nobody there that I knew from my past. I could just be, and everyone said I was glowing, and my sister saw the photo,
right,
and glowing, like there was something different about you, and it's like, and it was like, yes, that's because I was able to actually be myself. And so when I'm here, like it's more difficult, not because I don't feel loved by those people, or they wouldn't accept me, but just because it's so familiar to be someone else, and they treat me as someone else, because like it's just really difficult, and it's a challenge, because you're right, it's like that other self has died in a way, and you are a different person, and you can't go back, and nor should you. So maybe
what the role of clergy, and that can be for any faith tradition, is maybe it's our role is to model how to grieve.
Yeah.
I really opened the door up for the one token Jew that's been aching for a chance to probably speak on sitting Shiva or something like that. But
well, you know, I was actually thinking about sitting Shiva this week. You know, we're starting to have deaths from this virus, and you know, the people whose family members die from this are going to have to go into quarantine, right? They've been exposed to the virus. If they didn't know that they had the virus before they got critically ill, then they know now, and they have to go into 2 weeks quarantine. And I was thinking about sitting Shiva, right? But in sitting Shiva, you stay in, but the community comes to you. And what is it to be alone and not have,
we got together and Zoomed earlier this week. No, it's not right. The same as sitting around the cigar lounge, but a community was held in a sense.
Right.
Yeah, and recently the rabbinic board in the conservative movement has said it's okay to have a virtual minyan if someone needs to say Kaddish while observing the anniversary of a death.
Yeah, good. I was wondering about that.
Yeah. So that has happened, but no, I'm not gonna say that. Yeah, resiliency. You know, if there was an ancient religion that has gone through a lot that you could turn to as an example, that's got a 1,500-year head start on you, that would be nice. But you know, it's a bad time of year for this kind of stuff. You know. Mm-hmm. To be Jewish, so I'm not going to interject that into
no.
It, no, this is a time of year historically where Jews tend to lay low, especially when there's a pandemic.
Right, right,
right.
You know, but also, I mean, a lot of what we've been talking about, it's human. It goes across all faiths or lacks of faith and any expression, because grief is a human experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, I think everything we've been saying is things that I think a lot of people know, but they don't realize they know it. So it's things that have to be said and repeated, and so that's why I think, you know, the value in this discussion, and it's one we could keep having for a long time, and I'm sure we will on other occasions. But it's getting late in England. We don't want to keep James up late
or early, depending on how you look.
Depending on how you look at it. I really appreciate. working out a schedule that
so I've held my peace, Charles.
Okay, go ahead.
So what part of England are you originally from? Are you been in, I know London's a very broad term and encompasses many communities, so I'm trying to place the accent.
Okay, well, I come from just outside southwest London, so I come from like Surrey.
Okay,
which is a county just like just outside southwest London. Like I come from a town called Epsom, which is in Surrey. The town that I grew up in is where the Queen often goes to watch horse racing.
Ah.
There's a horse race called the Derby, which happens every year at Epsom Racecourse, and the Queen has often attends. There's the Queen stand there where she tends to go. So Epsom is kind of a middle class town with a bit of upper class in it, but I'm from the middle class section of it.
My wife and I lived in Oldham for 2 years.
Oh my gosh, what happened?
Yeah, that's one word phrase people said after coming over to visit. But
yeah, Oldham, crikey, that's a bit.
Yeah, we moved in right after the race riots, so that was that was my first introduction to my new parish. Was it's on CNN? I'm like, oh, that's most troubling.
But London, yeah, London's kind of. I always say I'm from London. I mean, that's kind of where I live now, anyway. So, well, I love London. London's great. So that solves that mystery.
Yeah. See, I would have done that, Charles, in the opening, but you know,
yeah,
I'd save it to the end.
We'll save it to the end. It's always it was good. That was okay. So, some words of wisdom. Of course, this is totally random.
As always.
But you're going to have to think about the connection here because this is not about grief, but it does relate to our guest. And so this quote comes from one of my favorite authors, which I get you would sure assume that he's one of my favorites, is Jonathan Swift. And he said that one of the best rules in conversation is never to say a thing which any of the company can reasonably wish had been left unsaid.
Geez, it's like every podcast.
Exactly.
Was that the connection?
Well, the connection is part of James's podcast is The Lost Art of the Conversation.
Yeah, and I'm actually quite passionate about this because I feel like this has been something that we've lost. Because you can't... a healthy conversation means that you listen to the other person and you hear and acknowledge what they're saying and you respond to that.
Mm-hmm. And you can see how well Chris and Helena listen to.
No, I was going to do a shameless plug for James since I'm in this quarantine state and looking for things to do. Download it on Kindle because that's... Charles will probably get on me about that, not turning actual paper and page, but his book, Mosaic of Grace, God's Beautiful Reshaping of Our Broken Lives. And I have to say that I've got through the introductory stuff, but I have not started chapter one because I knew that when I did, I'm one of those people that try to read it straight through no matter what. But and plugging it. I'm excited about reading through it.
On Amazon, I'd love people to check that out. Feels like it's appropriate right now. But yeah, I mean, in terms of conversation, there was this, I don't know if you've heard of him, but there's this great British interviewer in the 70s to the 90s called Michael Parkinson. And he interviewed every famous person on TV, and famous people wanted him to interview them. And the thing that he used to do is he used to let them talk and he listened to them and he responded to what they were saying. And he did ask questions, but it was more about them than about him. And he really listened and it was a proper conversation. And so when I started a podcast, that was what I wanted to do. It was like, okay, let's just have a conversation and I'll listen to you and I'll ask a few questions and we'll have a discussion, like a healthy discussion. And we'll probably agree on most things, but we might not. But just have a healthy discussion and listen to each other and try and learn from each other. Because that's what healthy conversation does. And it feels like today that we're not allowed to do that. Like on social media, everyone's just trying to win the argument. Like, I'm right, you're wrong, listen to me. Like, I'm not going to listen to you. And that's not actually healthy. We need to listen to each other and have healthy conversations. Because that's how we grow. And that's how we become mature, I think, is to listen to other people. So that's what I try and do in my podcast, yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Dogs of the COVID apocalypse. You can hear them yet again in the background. Enjoyed this.
Yeah,
this is good.
Yes, great. This has been really
do it
great.
Again.
Yeah.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
I'm Helena Epstein, and I'm still the Ampersand of Reason.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile. Walk into a bar mitzvah. Wishing I could change
the things that I... Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/EthanSapphire. Can't give back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from your mistakes, you'll get another chance at that.